We are all assembled. Before we begin today, our marshal is going to show you in the upper left-hand corner of your screen how we're keeping time, since we're doing this virtually. When it's time for you to begin, I will, of course, ask you to start, but you'll see a green start sign. When you have 5 minutes to go before your time is expiring, you'll see a yellow 5 minute sign. And when the time that's been allocated to your argument is concluded, you will see a red stop sign. I'll try to help you keep track of the last sign, and we'll always let you answer a question that has been posed by a justice. So, you just go ahead and answer the question. If you're unsure, I'll remind you that it's okay to go ahead. But I probably won't let you go far beyond just answering that question. So we tend to keep within the time that was allocated. Before I call our first case today, you will probably notice by your screen that there are six justices sitting on this case, and we will sit six. Justice Ann Bradley has withdrawn from participation, so she will not be participating in the decision conference or the writing or approval of opinions that will come out of this case. With those remarks, I will now call our first case of the morning, Portage County versus E.R.R. Attorney Marion, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, I am.
Please do.
Morning, and may it please the court. I'm Colleen Marion, and I represent the petitioner, Mr. E.R.R. His pseudonym is Elliot, and he's watching us today on YouTube. The most important issue in this case is whether the government unlawfully committed and medicated Elliot. I think it's pretty clear that the answer is yes. However, Elliot understands that before we get to that question, we need to have a conversation about mootness because the order at issue has expired. We're asking the court to hold that appeals from 5120 involuntary commitments should not be dismissed as moot simply by virtue of the expiration of the underlying order. This holding will fit into the court's well-established doctrines relating to mootness and is the logical next step. There are two primary avenues that the court can go down to reach this holding. The first is the collateral consequences doctrine, and the second is the well-established exceptions to mootness. This court has gone down both avenues within the last 2 years. I'd like to begin with collateral effects. This court has already recognized at least two of the relevant collateral effects at issue in involuntary commitment appeals. First, in DK, this court recognized that the firearm ban attached to the commitment order was a collateral consequence that would be affected by relief as requested by the petitioner.
Counsel, could you address the state's arguments in the state's briefing regarding collateral consequences, that even if we would accept your argument regarding collateral consequences for Elliot in particular, that the existence of other orders would sort of negate your argument. Could you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. And first I would say that each commitment or recommitment is a separate adjudication of mental illness, treatability, and dangerousness. So each order will also carry with it its own set of collateral consequences, including the liability for cost of care. I also wanted to specifically address the county's argument on the firearm ban. The county argues that because Elliot was previously committed and that we weren't collaterally attacking that order, that the firearm ban is of no import. I find it troubling to resolve these cases based on other orders that are sometimes not even part of the appellate record. And I think it does open the door to appellants then trying to collaterally attack those orders, which enhances the likelihood that we're going to be spending more judicial time and resources on mootness instead of getting to the issues that really matter.
Let me ask you specifically about the firearms ban. If Elliot were subject to that under the original commitment and that had been maintained, then wouldn't that kind of eliminate your argument regarding the firearms ban with respect that continued under an extension, for example?
I think the county acknowledges that there's a legal avenue for removing a firearm ban. And again, I don't think that we can assume that the prior order will not be amended in that way in the future. And I find it unfair to set a deadline on proof of collateral consequences. I also wanted to note that in DK, this court didn't set a limit on or a restriction on its holding, limiting it to original orders. Instead, it repeatedly focused on the order at issue in the appeal. So I think that supports a conclusion that this court has really already painted in broad strokes that if the order on appeal has a firearm ban, then the appeal is not moot.
Can I follow up on that, counsel, just to make sure I understand your argument? So what you're saying is, listen, the original commitment, the firearm ban that results from that, that could be lifted at some later point in the future or modified at some later point in the future. And if in the recommitment would serve as, you know, essentially reimposing that. And so this could have import somewhere down the line, and that should be enough in order to grant a collateral consequence here and say that there's a meaningful effect to this for him, or at least could be in the future. Is that right?
Yes, as specific to Elliot, I think that's exactly right. I will say that in other cases, the original commitment order might not even be in the appellate record because some counties establish new cases for each recommitment proceeding. And as to the former point or the first point, I think Cibron versus New York is really instructive. In that case, the Supreme Court was addressing collateral consequences for misdemeanor convictions whose sentences had already been served. And the court, you know, relied on the fact that prior convictions, they might be overturned in the future. And we don't know for sure that they're going to exist forever and that the case shouldn't be decided based on, you know, an uncertain fact.
Counsel, will you also, go ahead just a second and I can follow up when you're done.
Go ahead, Justice Sell. Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to move us to the cost issue. Because the argument there from the county is that costs weren't imposed here, and maybe they argue that they never really do it, even though the statute says shall impose costs. So how do you address that collateral consequence of costs?
Well, first, as to Elliot's case, there are facts that are outside the record that the county knows about, and there are facts outside the record that I know about by virtue of my professional relationship with Elliot. And I don't think it's appropriate for either party to ask this court to rely on that. So I can't verify, you know, that the county didn't or won't seek costs because that would be a separate civil action.
So let me ask it this way. Is there anything in the statute, 4610, that prohibits the county from going after Elliot at any point in time for the cost? Is there any time limit in that statute that would prohibit them from later on going after it? And in fact, does the statute appear to mandate that the department go after, or that the county go after Elliot costs?
I'm not aware of any time limit. I would note that there is an exception for cases where the person might not be able to pay. Again, any sort of ability to pay proceeding would be separate from the commitment proceeding, which makes sense because in the circuit court, when we're dealing with the commitment proceeding, mootness isn't that issue because we're talking about the commitment itself, and cost of care would not be able to be established at that point because they're ongoing.
So if he were to even come into money at some point later and they became aware of it, it's potential. Given that there's no time limits, that he could be responsible for paying the cost of care?
I'm not certain on that question. I'm not aware of any time limit in the statute.
Okay, thank you.
Whether other civil rules would apply, I'm not sure. But I did want to talk, that's exactly the next collateral consequence I wanted to discuss, because this court has already recognized financial liability as a collateral consequence in State versus McDonald. And McDonald was cited in this court's recent decision in DJW. One interesting point about the McDonald holding is that this court did not require proof of financial consequences specific to the case. Instead, it painted more broadly and used more equivocal language like may and possibly, which I think fits with the general preference in collateral consequences and not going case by case, but instead finding that collateral consequences are likely enough and prevalent enough so as either to not warrant case by case or at least to put the onus on the petitioner to disprove.
Can we talk about that likely enough and prevalent enough when it comes to your financial or debt argument? Do you know of any case in Wisconsin where after the fact, whether it be weeks, months, or years later, the county came back and told and required payment under the statute?
I'm aware of a case, Ethelyn IC, which was cited in one of Elliot's briefs, where the entire appeal was about recoupment of costs of care. And I think that the debt that that individual had was between $7,000 and $8,000. And I'm not clear on, I guess, the timeline for that, but I would assume, you know, that the costs were assessed after the commitment and it was an appeal simply on the costs.
What about the prevalency of this? I mean, it seems to me, just, you know, anecdotally from my experience as a circuit court judge, that every case, every Chapter 51 case that came before me, the person was found indigent almost every time.
Well, I think I have two answers to that point. First, I think it's somewhat, again, going down the case-by-case route is difficult because in terms of figuring out whether costs are assessed, there needs to be probably some fact-finding in the circuit court. I don't know how that would work. You know, again, I feel like trying to rely on costs of care in this case is difficult for me as the appellant because that would not be in this court record. As to the second point, I do know that the SPD appoints counsel in all Chapter 51 appeals, and I assume at the circuit court level too, regardless of indigency. So we do not do an indigency determination. Now, we might not see a lot of cases where people have means because they might choose to hire their own counsel. I think especially since, unfortunately, SPD has had a backlog of cases, and that has affected the appellate division, that certainly if you had means, it would be much preferable to skip over our backlog.
If I'm understanding your argument, though, counsel, what you're saying, though, on the collateral consequence point is that the mere fact that it imposes liability, regardless of when it might be collected or if at a given point of time it might be collected, shouldn't be relevant to that analysis. That what your argument before us is that because the statute imposes costs, you know, that's a liability that's sufficient for us to say we can adjudicate this because it has a meaningful effect on his legal liability, whether it's ever collected or not, might be a separate question. Is that a fair way of describing the argument you're making?
Yes, absolutely. And I think when there's a consequence that perhaps the, you know, the indebted person has the burden of lifting through their own efforts of showing inability to pay, I think that this court should find that the injury or the consequence of having the debt imposed, whether or not they're able to overcome that, should be enough as a collateral consequence. I did also want to discuss the fact that McDonald was a criminal case. There were basically two rationales for the finding, and one was that that the financial liability, but the other was the fact that the person had a constitutional right to appeal. And not all states have a constitutional right to an appeal, which is part of the reason I didn't hang my hat very heavily on what other states are doing. But Wisconsin is, in my opinion, great for that reason, that our constitution does afford somebody in a commitment appeal and everyone really to the right to an appeal. I did want to talk a little bit more about the reason why the assessment of collateral consequences shouldn't be case by case. And one of the reasons why is, again, that in general, when a party is moving to dismiss an appeal, they have the burden of proof to prove why that should happen. So it's for that reason, it's for Sibrin, it's for the impracticality of assessing collateral consequences case by case, that I would either ask this court to presume collateral consequences or at least require that the burden be on the county to prove why there's no possibility that collateral consequences will be present.
Can I question you ever prove a negative, counsel? I mean, you would be asking us to say that the county had to prove a negative, and I don't really know how you would do that, except to say the statute was unconstitutional, then probably they couldn't do it. But I don't think we ever give people a negative burden of proof.
One example, Your Honor, would be if perhaps the appellant had already secured the relief that they're seeking. So in SLL, the appellant had already achieved the voiding of the underlying order. And that's because the circuit court on its own had dismissed the entire proceeding and had vacated that order. Well, so I think that would be.
Were there costs sought in that proceeding?
You know, I'm not sure. That was not discussed in the decision. The only collateral consequence that was discussed was the use of commitment records in further proceedings. I'm sure the firearm ban didn't come up because, again, the order had already been vacated. I think that costs of care are only permitted on valid orders. So I believe that there's a case, I wish I could think, Jankowski, that okay. says if the order is overturned, the person does not have the financial liability.
Okay.
So I think the county certainly can try to prove in a given case that that it's moot, but I am just asking the court to hold that only pointing to the fact that the order is expired is not enough to prevail on a motion to dismiss. The next avenue that this court can go down and has gone down to find that an appeal should be decided on the merits is one of the five well-established exceptions to the mootness doctrine. And recently in DJW, this court held that the great public importance and evading review exceptions applied. And in that case, it was a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence on dangerousness, which is precisely the same issue in Elliott's case. Now, DJW had the additional sad fact that DJW had passed away during the appeal. And this court still elected to reach the merits on that case. It's interesting because when I read DK and DJW, they appeared to me to paint broadly. But the Court of Appeals has continued to engage in case-by-case analysis, at least in some cases. And it results in these very lengthy decisions on mootness instead of that maybe the same amount of time and resources that could be spent on the merits. And I would also note that that's not universally the approach that the Court of Appeals has taken. And that's part of what's really troubling to me about a case-by-case approach. For example, in DK, the county didn't raise a mootness argument. So the Court of Appeals simply said, you know, well, this wasn't alleged to be moot, so it's not moot, and we're just going to go ahead and decide the merits. And I think that unpredictability is, it's troubling, and it also is a reason why I don't think that this court should be concerned that it's the holding that we're proposing will result in an avalanche of future appeals. I think a reasonably diligent attorney cannot advise their client that the appeal will be dismissed as moot simply because the Court of Appeals is taking different approaches. I can't assure my client that their appeal won't be addressed on the merits.
Counsel, it's concerning to me too that there are people like your in your client's position who their orders expire and then courts fairly routinely deem their appeals to be moot. But I was, as I was reading the briefs, I was thinking about, is there another approach the court could take rather than having a blanket rule that none of these cases are moot? Maybe there's an adjustment that could be made in the rules of appellate procedure to expedite these, given the shortness, certainly, of the original commitments, which last only 6 months. Is that an approach that would alleviate the issues that your client has experienced and others like him?
I think if you asked anybody whether they'd rather have their decision made in time to get them off the order, whether they would prefer a decision after they've expired, they're going to say the former. And I think that needs to be a priority in this state to make adjustments to make sure that people are getting timely appeals in these cases. It is not an issue that was raised in this case. I think the court has superintending authority. One example I thought of was that in juvenile waiver appeals, this court had instructed the Court of Appeals to make sure that they were deciding those appeals on a shorter timeline. Part of the problem is that these appeals are under 80930, which contemplate a lot of time passing. Whether that would be a legislative fix or if this court wanted to exercise its superintending authority, I think it's really important because these are incredibly important cases. People's liberty is being deprived, and it shouldn't just be accepted that that's just the way it has to be. There are ways.
Attorney Marion, in this case in particular, your client did try to get an expedited appeal and was not successful. And then in the subsequent commitment, that has since been overturned. So in theory, had your client been able to get a successful appeal on the first commitment that we're here about today, potentially that could have been overturned at that point. I don't know what kind of new evidence there was, and I don't know if the record includes that, but is that your argument or is that your understanding?
It's possible, but there were other problems in terms of in the first appeal, he was waylaid in the SPD backlog. So it would have been a tight squeeze anyway, although we did file a motion for summary reversal as well because we believe that the issue was very, very clear cut. But certainly, you know, it's Elliot's very glad to be off commitment, but he was on an illegal commitment for a year and close to 9 months of his life. So in some ways, it's not all sunshine. So I certainly think that the expedited appeal process is problematic too, in that each of the districts is up to them if they want to formulate one of those programs, and it's also voluntary. I don't blame the county for this, the first appeal not being expedited, because my understanding is that the paperwork didn't make it where it needed to be. But again, that's another part of the problem, is it's an unusual process. In this district, the Court of Appeals sends out a piece of paper asking you to check a box if you're interested in participating, but you mail it back to a staff attorney. You don't file it with the clerk. And so I just think that the process needs to be more uniform if people are going to be treated equally. So for the reasons we've discussed, we're asking the court to, you know, follow its well-established doctrine of mootness and to, you know, to guarantee the right to meaningful appeal, which won't sacrifice anything in the way of judicial resources, and to reach a holding that is very well called for, which is that 5120 involuntary commitment appeals should be decided on the merits, and they should not be dismissed as moot simply because the underlying order has expired. Thank you.
Attorney Sweeney, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. I'm Attorney Brianna Sweeney. I am Interim Deputy Corporation Counsel with Portage County. I am representing the county and respondent on this matter. This case is being heard today based on Elliot's appeal that his commitment order that did expire a few years ago is not moot and should be overturned. At this point in time, we are of the opinion that it is moot. We do believe that the collateral consequences put forth by Elliot are of a hypothetical nature and do not directly affect Elliot. I think that in this case, there is not any practical legal effect upon an existing controversy that would result by not finding this matter moot.
Counsel, has the county waived any financial liability that he incurs under the statute by operation of law?
So when Justice Dallet made the comment that the statute said shall incur expenses, I was under the impression that it was a passive statute, and I do believe that's how we cited it in our brief, that it said may, that a county may bring forth an action. And if that is incorrect, then that is my incorrection. Obviously, I can't check the statute right here because I don't have it in front of me. I just have my brief. But I will
chime in a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think you're correct that they may enforce it, but the statute itself says in sub 2, any committed person shall be liable for the cost of care, maintenance, services, and supplies. The department shall make collection, that's sub 3, and in sub 7, the department shall administer and enforce this section. So whereas you cited the one provision of how they may enforce or may issue in order to compel, the rest is worded as shall.
Okay. So in Elliot's case, there are not any financial orders that we are attempting to make at this point. He does not have any financial liability to the county. We are not seeking any financial anything from him at this point in time. I don't expect that we will.
Can I follow up on that though? And sure, the question absolutely. I asked Attorney Marion is, he shall be liable. Whether you may or may not do this at this point, does it prevent the county from at some point, let's say he comes into money, let's say he's involved in some other, let's say he's involved in a new commitment and you realize that he has the liability for the old one and that he has financial ability to pay. What prevents the county from later seeking the money? He is liable pursuant to the statute.
And I do have to admit that, again, I was misunderstanding what the statute was reading. And so when it said may, that's something that we kind of hung our hat on. It isn't a practice that this county typically does. So I understand Attorney Marion did make that point that just because we don't doesn't mean we won't. It is still possible. At this point in time, I can say there is not. And I think it's a hypothetical possibility and not a standard consequence to the case. I think a lot of what Elliot relies upon are hypotheticals and not concrete actual consequences of that commitment order. As Attorney Marion did discuss the firearms ban, because there is an underlying order, there is a firearms ban, and that is a lifetime ban. The original commitment was a lifetime ban. He does have the ability to overturn that firearms ban, but his recommitment order doesn't change that from the underlying order. And I think Attorney Marion did make an argument in the brief that the firearms ban, the fact that this wasn't overturned could affect his ability to get the firearms back in the future. However, again, that's hypothetical. Like a lot of what Elliot puts forth in his brief with regard to collateral consequences are hypothetical and not actual consequences that he is suffering. He's not currently suffering any liability for costs. He's not currently suffering the firearms ban would be there regardless of whether or not he had this overturned, and it would be such that there isn't any effect if this case were overturned. Counsel does mention Sibron versus New York, and as she mentioned in that case, it was determined that in all criminal convictions going forward, it is presumed that it is not moot. And I know that there was an amicus brief filed as well that stated we should do that for all mental health commitments as well. I think that that is a different scenario. Criminal convictions are, they have succinct statutory consequences attached to them. And that's similarly what happened in State versus McDonald. While even though he did pass away, those financial consequences were attached to him because of that conviction. Overturning that conviction would change those results, whereas overturning the commitment doesn't automatically change any of the consequences that are alleged in Elliott's brief. I think in Sibron, similarly, I think with regard to criminal convictions, they're also something very important to note is they're of public record and they have long-term concrete consequences. So when you are convicted of a crime, that's public record. Your landlord can find that. Your employer can find that. The government can find that. And that can be used against you in the future. Whereas with the mental health commitment, we do really hard to keep these confidential and keep these put forth in their own place.
Counsel, I'd like to move on to the merits if we could. Which of the five dangerousness showings is the county relying on here, and what evidence supports the showings that you are relying on?
Thank you. Okay, so when we brought forth this case, it was in January of 2019. At that point in time, I think it was a relatively well-established idea that the court could rely specifically on 5120 sub 1 sub 8M, which was previously considered to be an alternative and evidentiary path to prove the prong of dangerousness. I do believe that DJW did clarify that and did state that it needs to be connected to one of the five standards, but I don't know that it was necessarily seen that way prior to DJW, at least not clearly.
And my problem with that is that, you know, AM does lay out other ways to prove that someone is currently dangerous, but even by its very terms, it still requires one of those to be met. So can you, at this point, name any of the five that are there that the evidence supports showing that he was dangerous?
So I think one thing that the judge did say in the case was that his lack of insight into his mental illness provided him with such impaired judgment that he would be a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn. It's not the exact language of the impaired judgment dangerousness standard, but I think that that is where the judge was going with it.
So you're relying on the third one, C, evidence of an impaired judgment, and says manifested by evidence there's substantial probability of physical impairment or injury to himself or herself or other individuals. And which evidence in the hearing suggests that there would be physical impairment or injury? Or is there any testimony that you feel like supports that notion?
I think it goes back to his longstanding struggles with chronic mental illness. The doctor does talk about his variable levels of compliance with treatment that lead up to a variety of... Oh, I'm sorry, that's the wrong one. Let me, if I may, grab my brief just to go back to the facts. In that case, I did outline some. So he testified a lot about the fact that Elliott doesn't recognize that he or acknowledge that he is mentally ill. He does discuss the fact that he has moments of clarity in which his symptoms are diminished and not that of dangerousness, which is where he was at the exact time of the hearing. But then he goes on to discuss that, and then his symptoms come back and he becomes dangerous again. His I believe he specifically talked about his previous issues that he's had with other commitments and why he was under a commitment and the various types of the hallucinations and things that he had prior. And I do believe that the court relied upon the fact that because of that, he was, and because of the fact that his symptoms had gotten better based on the fact that he was being currently treated, and the idea that there was an alternate evidentiary path that they could take under AM, that was what he relied upon.
So are you just, are you relying on the third standard there in C, or are there any of the other of the five that you are arguing to us today that the evidence would satisfy?
I think I'm primarily relying upon the impaired judgment because that was actually what the judge did put in his record.
Thank you.
And I did, on that note, I did just want to note, with regard to the finding of an alternate evidentiary path, in JWK, Portage County versus JWK, that case was determined to be moot. However, there was a concurrence and a dissent in that case in which they did actually analyze the sufficiency of the evidence. And I believe Justice Dallet did mention that that he did state, if I may, while the testimony supporting Dr. Persing's opinion is as to JWK's current dangerous was minimal, that it was concluded the findings of the circuit court were not clearly erroneous and must be upheld. And I think the testimony in JWK is very similar to that of Elliott's. It spoke very broadly of what would happen if treatment were withdrawn and the fact that his symptoms would return. And so I did, I did rely upon that analysis in my brief.
I have a question regarding that, and I don't remember all the facts of JWK, but I do recall that there was some testimony of other than just return of symptoms. And here, what is the testimony other than just that Elliott is going to have symptoms again? I don't see any testimony of regarding Elliott's inability to take care of himself or dangerous outbursts or anything like that in this record. It's a very bare record in terms of what this testimony was.
Yeah,
I
think primarily it was that if treatment were withdrawn, the symptoms would return, and that that he lacks insight into the mental illness and he would likely stop taking those medications, which would result in the cyclical.
Right. Yeah. So basically what we're saying then is that anybody who has symptoms from mental illness can be committed because the symptoms could return if they stop taking the medication. And if they don't recognize they've got an illness, they may stop taking the medication. But where's that link to dangerousness? Where's that link to dangerous to self or others other than symptoms?
I think it just lies in the fact that the idea that if you withdraw the treatment, the commitment would be needed. I think that was, it was just not beyond, it wasn't stated beyond that. It was, that was enough. And that's what the judge thought that was enough.
I appreciate your candor. Thank you.
Is there any testimony, just to follow up on that again, I just want to make sure I'm not missing anything. Is there any testimony in the record that you can point us to that would point to under the third standard, either in the past, you know, a probability of physical impairment or injury to himself or herself or other individuals?
I don't think that that was clearly laid out in the record.
Okay, thank you.
So further, I guess it would go back to the idea of arguing with regard to whether or not this is moot. I do think the idea of ridding the entire system of the mootness doctrine for 51 cases is difficult, as was done in Sibrin. I think that it would not remedy the issues of timeliness and that. I think it's an interesting.
Justice Bradley, do you want to go ahead?
Go ahead.
Okay. I think this is a quick question, maybe not. Attorney Marion talked about juvenile waiver appeals and how those are expedited. And she is asking us to think about using our superintending authority she talked about a legislative fix, which of course we couldn't do, but I want to know what your position is on us using our superintending authority, or if there's some other way for us to put these 51 commitment appeals on an expedited track. How do you feel about that? What's your position?
So I appreciate Attorney Marianne putting forth that this was requested to be an expedited appeal. And I actually do think that, as opposed to getting rid of mootness entirely, I think having them being required to be expedited actually makes a lot of sense. Because if they were incorrect, they should be decided and overturned where they still have a direct effect on individuals. I actually think that that's correct. I think the problem here is we're in front of you because there isn't really any direct effect on Elliot if this gets overturned because it was incorrect. I mean, he doesn't suffer any, or he doesn't gain any benefit from having this overturned because he's not under commitment anymore.
Today he does.
Correct. Whereas right. If it was expedited and we had been decided while he was still under commitment, it would have had an effect then. And I do think that that's a fair point that Elliot does lay out.
Thank you. Thanks, Justice Bradley.
Counsel, my question related to a statement that the Court of Appeals judge made in his opinion, and this was a one-judge opinion, as they all are, unless it goes to a full panel, which this one did not. But the judge said that one of the reasons he gave for not deciding the merits of Elliott's case is that it is a one-judge decision. It's not publishable, and it's not citable as persuasive authority. But that would be the case in every case. So that was something that troubled me about the Court of Appeals judge's decision in this case. So could you respond to that?
So, and that is something we did kind of touch on in our brief, is that if mootness doesn't exist, every single opinion that goes to the Court of Appeals is decided on merit, and every single opinion is one panel judge and unpublished. And so you end up with a whole bunch of different opinions and different, there's nothing that clarifies anything for the lower courts, which is what the goal would be. And so that's why I think it's so important to keep the idea of mootness there, because there are cases in the 51 system that are moot. And it's not just because the case is expired, but because it would have no effect on anything. Like, it wouldn't change the outcome. But I do think that I also think that with regard to cases that if they are moot and there are exceptions to that mootness based on the expiration, they get to where they need to be. I mean, we have come before the Supreme Court on Chapter 51 cases a number of times. While the orders may be expired, the outcome of what comes from these cases still happens. And it does do what the cases leading up to it require it to do. It instructs the lower courts. It helps clarify any rule of law there may be. And I think that that's valuable in that way.
But sometimes it seems a case is moved.
Sorry. I'm sorry, you cut out.
I'm getting an echo. Maybe I should back away from the microphone. We have decided, this court has decided, that cases are moot as well. My concern, and I'm trying to figure out a way for the court to address it, is that a lot of these cases are going to be moot by the time they come to us. And we do have a guaranteed right of appeal for every litigant, not just in Chapter 51 cases. And so to your friend on the other side's point, there's a lot, I think she phrased it, there's a large class of people who are effectively denied an appeal on the merits under the grounds of mootness because, you know, frankly, their cases are moot under our jurisprudence, but should that deprive them of the opportunity to have a meaningful appeal on the merits in every single instance?
I think, and I see that argument. I think she did mention that it wouldn't have an avalanche effect. And I wonder if that wouldn't be the case, however. Because I do understand the timeliness. It's really difficult with the shortage of PD and how quick these orders turn around. But I do think that mootness is such an important doctrine. And the reason it's not allowed in criminal cases anymore is because there are succinct and clear consequences that are attached to a criminal conviction. That doesn't necessarily exist with commitments. And I think the idea that, you know, they're losing their right, well, they still have their right to appeal. If there's a valid grounds to have something overturned based on one of the mootness exceptions, it can be done. It just may not, if it's not the case, then there wouldn't be value there. But that, I do think there is a concern there with the 1 year turnaround time, and I can see how that could be, I could see how that could be difficult.
Do you see any problems from the county's perspective if the rules of appellate procedure were changed either legislatively or by this court through a rules petition and hearing process, if things were expedited, would that cause any issues for the counties from your perspective?
I think it could be difficult. However, I think at this point, the counties are all handling primarily their own appeals as it is. And we are still responding as it goes along and coming in front of you and coming in front of the appellate courts as maybe, I guess not in front of the appellate courts, but writing briefs and doing all of that. Expedited appeals are kind of a less stringent requirement. You don't have as much that you need to put in as you do in a full brief appeal. So I personally, I don't want to speak for all counties. I don't think it would be a huge burden, but also we're fully staffed and I have great staff and help and things. So I don't want to make a broad statement for all the counties.
We'll make sure all your friends know that you qualified the statement.
So I think just based on that, I would ask that the court not rid the entirety, the system of mootness entirely. I think that there is a basis for mootness in some cases and a lot of cases. I don't think that there's a presumed collateral consequence in this case beyond the statutory firearms ban. But again, that is different than when it's a recommitment than when it's a commitment. And I think that's the key. I think going forward, I would just ask that this case in particular be found moot. I don't think Elliot has put forth anything that is actually collaterally consequence to him, and there wouldn't be any effect on this being overturned. And I think that's where Portage County ends. And I would just like to say thank you very much for your time.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Attorney Marion, are you ready for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. I wanted to start with the idea that these are one judge appeals and therefore a substantive body from them would not be meaningful. I think that is problematic because we have a lot of types of cases that are one judge appeals, such as termination of parental rights cases. And I also don't want to shortchange how important, you know, these decisions are to the individual judges and parties. You know, I don't think that trial judges get a decision from the Court of Appeals, take a look at it, say, oh, well, the order's expired, and then toss it in the recycling bin. I think that they care what the Court of Appeals has to say about what they've done in these cases. They take them very seriously, as they should, because they're huge deprivations of liberty. I also think that I wanted to mention about the firearm ban and sort of how the domino effect might be. If there was an original commitment that had a firearm ban, the appeals on the recommitment, we're asking the court to void the order, get rid of that firearm ban. And then the county saying, well, we still have the original. But what if the original was vacated by a circuit court judge? Now we still have the recommitment firearm ban. And so that's why I really think that the court needs to put an end to these case-by-case analyses. We just don't know what's going to happen in the future. And if we start, like, continue the case-by-case analysis, then we're going to get into, well, what if it's a first recommitment? What if it's a second, third, fourth? What does that do to stigma, which I didn't talk a lot about, but I think is massively important. People are discriminated against, even if these are closed records. I mean, try to get placement of your child, you know, in a group home. It's not going to happen. And so then we're talking about, well, was there an original 20 years ago? And now we have an original again. And do we have to dig through all those old files to see if the firearm ban attached to the original order? And so I don't think that the court has to do anything radical with mootness doctrine to reach our holding. I think we have the established doctrine of collateral consequences that applies. We have exceptions to mootness, and I think it can be fairly presumed that at least one of those exceptions is going to apply in the vast majority of cases. And I think to bring, you know, clarity, uniformity, and just reason to this area of the law, that the court should just put an end to case-by-case analysis, unless, you know, like I said, there might be situations where a case would be moot, but it shouldn't just be by reference to the fact that the order has expired. I did want to also mention that in, you know, this is a Portage County case, so was JWK, same doctor testified, and the dissent even noted that the evidence was pretty paltry. So unfortunately, it doesn't seem like the lesson, you know, was learned from that notation, and maybe it would have been if the order had been reversed. I also wanted to mention there was testimony about altercations in JWK. In Elliot's case, he was described as polite and very good to work with, and you know, might have delusions, but we don't know what those were. You know, he might believe that he can cure cancer. I don't see how that's dangerous to anybody, and maybe he can. So I just think that this is, it can't be allowed to stand, this commitment order. It was a massive injustice, and it matters a lot to Elliot, and it matters to me, and I think it matters to the judge and to other parties too, to make sure that that wrong is addressed. The last point I wanted to address was that the use of the term currently by the county. Again, I'm not sure how we make these factual findings about some of these collateral consequences without some sort of evidentiary hearing, especially with stigma. That seems really tricky to me. I don't know if we're supposed to remand and then have Elliot get on the stand and talk about how, you know, how these commitments have negatively affected his life, whether there should be an evidentiary hearing to talk about costs of care. I just think that it's not consistent with the way that the court system works. And I'll conclude with that, unless there are any further questions.
I have one question. Was there any reliance on the past record of his conduct, which wasn't a man who was polite and easy to work with?
Well, I'm not sure. I'll be candid. I still don't know what the behavior was that formed the basis for Elliot's original commitment. Handled two of his appeals now, and there's no hint.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you both. Commitments are always important, and you did a very nice job working with us on a virtual oral argument. Hopefully it won't be too long, and we'll all be able to be beyond COVID-19. But thank you again. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 11 o'clock. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.